I don't think anybody would be able to, even if we showed them, I don't think you could capture the glory and the beauty of this building, this venue, the Swedish American Hall. Is that right?
Yeah. Is this the first time you've played this venue? Because I've done a ton of interviews here, and I've come here a lot. Isn't this an amazing? Isn't this a wild place?
This is old hat to you. It's new to me. It's new to all the Calder Quartet as well. But we were blown away. We had heard good things. Actually, we saw a review shortly before arriving here that this was picked as one of the best venues in the area and the best vibe, and it sure is. I mean, we're very grateful and happy to be here.
Yeah, and you can be Swedish for just one night.
I was in Sweden actually a few weeks ago and was thinking about that here, but I haven't been able to.
But you didn't play at the American Hall in Sweden.
No, not there, not in Sweden, but that would be fun.
Oh, yeah. I guess we should have you introduce yourself, shouldn't we?
Sure. My name is Andrew W.K.
Party mindset of the day. Remember that even when life feels hard or scary, I'm here cheering you on and we'll keep going. I think that you're using Twitter in a really groovy way, not only to say, hey, we're having a rock show tonight, but you're also using it, you know, to pull through some of the other things you do.
I have been very excited about the computer. And one of the great things about the computer is the internet. And one of the great things about the internet is the ability to communicate with people that you might not otherwise have an opportunity to if you were going to see them in person. So I think Twitter is amazing in the ability that it gets all these different people a chance to see a slice of someone else's life. And in addition to that, you can send a message out there. I mean, it really is sending messages. So even though they say, what are you doing right now? And you're supposed to say, oh, I'm doing this interview right now. You can also put a little vibe out there, a little idea to think about, a mindset like we just talked about, anything that would give someone a new concept to process, or even a reminder, a familiar concept that maybe they want to stay in touch with. So I myself have always enjoyed getting advice from people or getting pep talks from people, my parents especially, and I feel like my mom is my greatest source of advice and inspiration, and I try to share those little things. So my mom is always there cheering me on. She's my biggest fan, my dad too. And if I can offer that to some friend out there who wanted a little boost today, then maybe that tweet will help them. San Francisco, I realized earlier today, I was thinking, what is it about this place that I love so much? And why do I have these feelings about this city versus so many other cities I've been to that seem so great? It's because I think New York City and San Francisco were the two cities that I visited frequently with my parents growing up that made this huge impression on me. We went to lots of other cities, but they just didn't, for whatever reason, this city really freaked me out, and I felt overwhelmed and scared and also fascinated. And New York had that same quality as well. And I think that alone has the ability to, for the rest of your life, make an impact that will last forever. I mean, even if I never end up living here as much as I would like to, I'll never be able to shake that sense of wonder and fear and excitement that I got coming here as a 8-year-old.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing because you didn't exactly grow up far from here, but all you have to do is go that 30 miles away down to the peninsula, even to this day, and it's an entirely different vibe. It's an entirely different world. So you started learning classical piano at age 4, and then you studied jazz. So where did rock and roll find its way into the picture?
Not till much later. Of course, I'd heard rock music probably once I started school, because then there was other kids that were listening to music, and they could share what they were into and play new songs for me. But it actually wasn't until high school that I really, really got into rock music and started to understand the power that it had. I never was against it. I didn't have an older brother or older sister living with me. I didn't have a lot of other kids in the neighborhood that could turn me onto things. So I really relied on school and the other students to share what they were into. And I'm very grateful they shared what they did, because it introduced me to levels of excitement and energy that I never would have been able to conceive of otherwise.
Your first band was age 13, and I just have to read you some of these, and then you have to at least tell me the meaning behind some of these names, because I love them. You know, Slam, Reverse Polarity, and then there was Lab Lobotomy, the Pterodactyls, Mr. Velocity, Hopkins, Cathode, the Portly Boys, Kangoo, the Beast People, Stormy Rodent, then a later iteration of Scheme, the Malt Lickers, Isis and Werewolves, and the Sucking Coeds, and Ancient Art of Boar. Wow. So that's a pretty, that, you know, when we're talking about band names, that is a plethora of fabulous rock band names, you know, so you could like just do one song under each of those in a compilation someday and not tell anybody it's you.
A lot of those names I did not make up. So first I got to give credit where credit is due. Like Mr. Velocity Hopkins, for example, the Pterodactyls, Reverse Polarity, Ices and Werewolves, Sucking Coeds. None of those I made up. A Scheme I didn't make up. The ones I did make up, like Lab Lobotomy, for example, originally the name of the band was Lobotomy, and we spelled it by accident L-A-B-O-T-O-M-Y, which was incorrect. So then when someone pointed that out to us, much to our horror, we decided, okay, well, we'll keep that first part and we'll spell it right after that. And actually, it made sense because a lobotomy is a procedure you'd hope to have in a laboratory of some kind.
And rock and roll can do that to you automatically anyway.
I guess so, yeah. So, I mean, the names, those names, when they're at their best, they have hidden meanings that reveal themselves to you, even if you made them up over many years. And it's amazing to think that I got to play in all these different groups. A lot of them were the same people, but each one had a special feeling.
I read that your, and you never know whether these things are accurate, that your first technical release was on cassette and sold 35 copies or something to that effect.
I thought it was that many.
But that must have been at that moment in time, just to release your first Andrew WK release, whether it sold 5 copies or not. The fact that someone else was popping a cassette in and listening must have just been awesome.
That's a magical feeling, absolutely. And you've described it very well. The idea that someone that I had never met, that I may never have reason to ever meet, that maybe has no connection to me other than the fact that they took this risk to, especially back then, before I had done anything at all, I mean, that someone took a risk to say, well, I'm going to buy this tape, this cassette, and see what it's like. And I can only imagine what that would be like for them to get the cassette and to listen to it. The music on those early cassettes was pretty intense, and for me, even now, unusual. But it still blows my mind when I think about even 1,000 CDs, right? The amount of space that 1,000 CDs takes up, that's a lot, let alone 100,000 CDs or 1,000,000 CDs. So things like that are always exciting to think about. And I'm always grateful that anybody at all would go and take it upon themselves to not only put down money, but to take the time to buy a product or to listen to it. That's amazing.
Being that you make the music you make, and the music you make comes from your heart and your soul, you're not trying to start a trend. You're doing what you do. But the songs have really been spread throughout so many things. I mean, you've had more syncs, more things in video games, more in commercials, more in movies than the 98% of the bands that form for the sole purpose of getting their music in a video game. So do you think that it's just because it's populist music, that it's music that you're making just really good, fun rock and roll, and you're not trying to per se change the world with it?
Well, that's a good question. If someone had told me that I would have the opportunity to put my music in a TV ad or in a movie or something like that, I don't know how I would have reacted back then. But at the same time, I came from a place that was what some would call experimental or very odd sounding music. And so I did make a very conscious choice to want to reach out to a large amount of people. I didn't want people to get tripped up on things like the sound or the style. I wanted them to feel this feeling of excitement. It's the only way I can really describe it. You can't really describe the feeling that I wanted to give people, but if you felt it, you're aware of it. And I also liked the idea of not going, a lot of my friends and myself included were very against the idea of big companies, very against the idea of corporations in general or corporate music and TV and all kinds of stuff. We were against so much. So I ended up getting really excited about the idea of contradicting those own beliefs for me or those own limitations I put on myself. And I figured that this music was a good way to push past those things, to kind of test those waters, to see what would happen if you put your song in an ad. Would the world really come to an end? Would your music really somehow be damaged? And I think that this music, not all music, but this music is can withstand those pressures or withstand that context. And instead of my music being hurt by an advertisement, I felt like it was just that much more of an opportunity for someone to hear it. And I grew up, for example, without MTV. So the only time I maybe would get to hear a new song on TV would be through an ad or through it being put in someone's TV show. And I really liked the idea that maybe that this music would just have that much more chance to get through to someone without being sort of overly protective or keeping it too sacred for its own good.
And the one place that's really special to me that a song landed up, and I rediscovered, and I'll tell you my little tradition I have, was on this Village Voice compilation that came out right after 9/11. Wow. And it was a rediscovery for me, speaking of We Are a Corporation and all of that, of I Love New York City. And so I have a tradition that right around 9/11, every single year, I open the show, I do a full New York City thing, and I open it with I Love New York City. So my audience has really gotten rallied around that song. But I think that, you know, when you're talking about contribution, that, I think, to a lot of people became one of the most positive. And if, of course, if they sit and they listen to the lyrics, the irony of it is quite amazing.
It was very strange and shocking to me, because it's true. That song was written not that long before September 11, 2001, but at least a year. And when I was putting together the lyrics, I was thinking, okay, what would be some great things I could say? I want to do something to your town, like knock your block and terror. That word just came out. I had never used that word in a song before. I had never even thought to use that word, I guess, in conversation that often. But I thought, oh, that's a great word, and that fits the phrasing. I'm working on these lyrics. And then, lo and behold, just a few months later, I guess, when we were finishing the album, September 11th actually happened, and I thought, oh, this is interesting, because the album hadn't come out yet.
Right.
So I thought, oh, people are going to think that I wrote this about September 11th. And I thought, well, that's all right. But myself and my friends and the people working on the album were all freaked out even a little bit about the fact that here we had language that looks or sounds like it could be describing this terrible event, but in fact was written in celebration before the event even ever happened. But of course, for me, that song became that much more intense and powerful and meaningful. And my love for New York City has grown so much since then, I can barely even explain it. The city is so overwhelming that I think it does take about 10 years to finally be able to receive it. And that's what I went through. But I always could tell that was the place for me, and I don't anticipate ever leaving.
You've got two parallel things going on. You've got Gundam Rock, and then you've got the 55 Cadillac Piano, which I watched the preview of that today. I watched the trailer for it, and it put a big smile on my face. Yeah. because what you do is you take your craft seriously, and that I can tell, and you want to make good songs, but there's also a sense of wanderlust about everything you do, and I imagine the whole J-pop thing fits into that really well, because they're a very serious, studious audience. Oh, yeah. But then once they go wild, they go crazy in Japan, right?
Japan is a miracle. It's a unique place out of all the places I've visited. Now, there's certainly plenty of places I haven't been yet, but I've never been anywhere that has the atmosphere of Japan. And the best way I can describe it is that in Japan, people are fans of being fans. They're passionate about being passionate. They get excited about the very idea of excitement. So for me, an artist who's working in that realm specifically, it was just like a match made in heaven. And I had visited Japan when I was 13 with my family before I ever really went there to do anything with music or ever knew too much about the culture. And I just was blown away. I said, the colorful quality of this culture is scratching me right where I itch, not just with music, but just existence in general. And I think I subconsciously or maybe very consciously manifested the success that we've had there since then. And I'm just very grateful to the Japanese people for embracing this feeling that I'm so pumped up on.
Well, I think with Andrew W.K. and everything you do, you know, and I don't think you do it to mess with people. You just do it because you've got such a wide-ranging background in music that it's very easy for people to turn around and say, oh, well, the guy plays loud rock and roll, and then you turn around and
play some piano. Yes, well, I edited myself very, very, very heavily for the first 5 years, really, of my career as Andrew WK. Before 2001, really, I played in all sorts of bands like the ones you listed and was interested in all sorts of music and just really was excited about the world in general. But I realized when I was going to present myself for the first time in earnest and really commit to the Andrew WK idea, it was going to take some holding back. At least for the beginning, I wanted to come out strong, but I also wanted to come out direct, and I didn't want to overwhelm people with a bunch of different things. I figured I could build a foundation, like almost like a stage. And then once I had built my own stage, I could perform on that stage. And the stage that I built was through those first songs, those first albums, this very direct, very basic rock and roll fun party excitement. But then what the most amazing part was getting to have that foundation and getting to really run wild and say, okay, now I can play piano. And I mean, that's the instrument I grew up with. Now, to some people, they think, oh, he's doing something very different. But to me, it's the return to the most basic thing I'd ever done.
You're really, in a radical way, keeping performance art alive too, aren't you, to a certain extent?
However anybody wants to take what I'm doing is fine by me. And I learned a while ago to let go of the need to be seen a certain way or the desire to have people think about you a certain way. I understand how I think about myself, and my close friends and family, we have an understanding. After that, it's free. It's free to everybody. And no viewpoint is wrong. If someone looks at a lecture I do or a dance on stage as performance art, then that's great, because as you said, there's amazing traditions within that genre. I just want to be me. I want to be my genre is being Andrew WK. And I want everybody to realize that their genre is being themselves, that you don't have to fit it into some kind of style or some kind of discipline unless that feels good to you. But for me, that started to feel very painful, and it started to feel almost detrimental to think about what I was doing in any kind of context. So I just thought, okay, well, the consistency with me will be that whatever I do, it'll be me doing it. And that was enough to see me through so far.
And the whole idea of trying versus doing. So can you, it's easy for someone to read it, but it's even better to hear you say it.
Sure. Well, actually, my dad is the one who told me this idea, but I've heard it echoed in all sorts of various places. I even heard Michael Bublé, is that how you say his name, the trumpet player?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He said something, he quoted Yoda with a similar sort of message. And the basic idea, I asked my dad one day, I said, Dad, well, the next thing I'm going to try to do is open this nightclub, or the next thing I'm going to try to do is play a solo piano show, or the next thing I'm going to try to do is do a lecture. He said, Andrew, you're past that point of trying things. Now you just do them. I mean, I didn't really have any response at the time. I said, okay, Dad. But then what he said really sunk in, and it's that any attempt is already the act of doing. And it's not, I mean, if you could look at opening a business as, well, first you get the money together, and then you find the location, and then you present your business plan to a bank, and they invest further, and so on and so forth. And you could think all of those steps were trying, but actually, once you get the business open, all of those steps were just part of doing it, part of opening the business, part of accomplishing whatever it is that you want to accomplish. And to be in the state of mind from the get-go that you're doing it versus trying to get there, that's much more empowering. So I just remind everybody that you're doing it all along, whether you realize it or not. And not only that, you're doing what you want to do, whether it feels like it's your will or not.
Kate doesn't normally come on these interviews. My audience knows her well, because she's actually the opening voice over on my Sunday radio show, my new music show. One day she turned to me and said, Daddy, there's this television show I want you to start putting on the DVR, and it's called Destroy, Build, Destroy. And so I watched it. And the first thing I turned to her, I said, okay, do you know who the host is? But is that some of the best fun you've ever had? I mean, it's got to be.
It absolutely is, for so many reasons. I mean, for the basic start, the show's premise is exciting no matter, I guess, who you are. Whether you're a very, very young person, whether you're an older person, working with explosions is exciting. It can't not be. I mean, that your body is designed to be excited by them. I think for your own safety, kind of. When you see a big bomb go off, you tend to want to run in the other direction, or at least your senses prick up in some form. So getting to be on this show where we're blowing things up, and I really mean blowing them up, that's very exciting. But second of all, I love the atmosphere of television. I was hooked on it from the very first time I ever got to do a TV interview, got to go to a TV studio, got to film my music videos. You're making something that is made to be disposable. But there's sometimes hundreds of people involved in making that thing. Just like music, it exists in a place where it's just in the air. It's not an object, right? You watch it on TV, but it's not the TV set that was made by somebody else. It's just colors and lights and things moving. So just the phenomenon of making a TV show is so strange. And third of all, I love getting to perform and work with these young people that are on the show. That's the best part of all to me, is being around people that are a little younger than me. And I hadn't anticipated how exciting and meaningful that would be, but just getting to, I guess, now that I'm a little older, getting to be around people that are looking at the world from a place of excitement, of wonder, who haven't even had the opportunity to become bitter or become jaded or to act like they know it all or have seen it all. They're just enthusiastic. And that's one of the greatest privileges that I've ever gotten to experience as an entertainer.
We do a thing called a musical sandwich. And it's two of your songs is the bread. Two Andrew W.K. songs is the bread. And then I just need a few other songs in between that you've just always wanted to play with your music. And it could be anything.